Welcome to Secular Matters, a monthly podcast on humanist and otherworldly issues. Every month, I will be talking with secular activists, humanist practitioners, researchers, and whoever has something interesting to say on the topic. Hosted by me, Andreas Kyriakou.
Hello, Kadisha. Welcome to Secular Matters. Very glad to have a chat with you again. We met at several secular conferences, so I know that you're an important voice for the community of ex-Muslims. You have a column in the Daily Mail. You're an editor for A Further Inquiry and also for The Freethinker, one of the oldest magazines of humanist, secular, atheist organizations. I think it started off in the 1880s.
Yes.
And has been, to my knowledge, running ever since. But before we talk about what you write about, what you think are important issues, do you want to say a bit more about who you are?
First of all, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity, Andreas, and it's a pleasure talking to you always, whether it is an event or this personal setting where we are doing this conversation. My name is Khadija Khan, and I'm a journalist and commentator. I am an editor at a Canadian magazine, A Further Inquiry, and a co-host of A Further Inquiry podcast. Apart from that, I'm an activist, I'm an ex-Muslim, I'm a human rights activist, and I'm a women's rights activist specifically, and I talk about minorities' rights and religious extremism within, specifically, I would say, Muslim community, because I'm coming from a particular background, so my analytical skills, you can say, on the issue of Islamic extremism and Islamism, a particular Islam, whatever name you want to give it, are evident, and I would like to apply them and use them in order to highlight certain issues which are crucial in terms of integration, assimilation, and women's right and women's place in Islam in Western context.
I think this really adds value that you, as someone who has grown up in a country, you're of Pakistani origin, in a country that is very much shaped by Islamic ways to organize society, so that you know from, say, the demands of certain Muslim communities or organizations, what the actual mindset is behind. And in a very recent column you wrote in the Mail, you criticized the exclusion of Muslim women and girls who had reached puberty from a charity run. And there you had given an example of your own childhood, which I found disturbing on one hand, of course, but also it showed me that it really makes it more plausible, convincing, I think, if someone like you speaks out, who knows this huge difference in how boys and girls are treated, how that is embodied in certain cultures. And the example you gave, I think it's worth mentioning, is that you were cycling as a young girl at the age of 8 and were molested by guys of your age who thought that was not appropriate. You went home to your dad and told what had happened to you, and the consequence he took was to ban you from cycling. So the problem to solve was not the boys molesting you, but you being a reason for them to be confused or whatever. Do you want to say a word about your journey through feeling and being a part of Islamic culture and how you then left it?
I was born and raised in Pakistan, and as you rightly said, that Pakistani society is largely shaped by Islamic teachings, though it's not a theocratic state, it's a democracy. However, the laws are very much based on Sharia compliance, and people, they are very much in a society where you have Islam as a state religion. I would say people adhere to religious orthodoxies way more than any other society where there is no state religion. So I was raised in that society, and the incident that you mentioned, it's huge in terms of how female children are treated in such religiously conservative societies. At the age of 8, when a girl is still a child and has age to enjoy and to be a child and just to hang around, have fun with her friends and all that, I was prohibited by my father for being too permissive outside, because for some reason I was responsible for what happened to me on the street, and I was prohibited from cycling, and not only from cycling, but also from going outside. That was the end of my childhood, basically, because I was not later on allowed to go out and play with my friends, because My father was like concerned about my safety, and in order to protect me, quote unquote, he forbidden me to go outside. And of course, it had a huge impact on my childhood. I suddenly stopped feeling like a child, you know, anymore. I felt like that I am a woman, and I was treated like a woman. I was given the veil, dupatta, to wear. And at some point, my father tried to make me wear hijab because according to his understanding, that was the age when I was supposed to be covering myself and the beginning should be with hijab. However, my mother, my grandmother, my mother's mother, I never saw them wearing any such clothing. Always I saw my mother and my mother's mother wearing the dupatta, the cultural dress of Pakistan that women would usually wear. But my father's family was quite conservative, so the women in my father's family would wear this burqa from head to toe. But still, my mother never wore it after marrying my father. But my father wanted us, like his daughters, to wear it. So he started with hijab. But I was, I would say, very fortunate to have a very brave and very bold mother who would go to any length to protect her kids. So this is what she did, actually. And she told my father that I didn't give birth to a slave. Right? These are not slaves. These are my girls. These are human beings, and they are not going to wear hijab or burqa like the way you want them to wear. Of course, she paid a huge price for disobeying my father, because for a Muslim woman, it's something that they are not allowed to do. Any disobedience may result in unabated violence, as it happened in the case of my mother. And she was not given, you know, the financial support that my father supposed to give her because she was merely a housewife. She got married at a very early age, like she was not even 15. She was just a housewife and she totally depended on my father. So that was the ordeal that my mother suffered in order to protect her daughter. So I grew up in that kind of environment. And of course, it had huge, huge impact on my life. On the one hand, I saw a religiously conservative father who wanted to oppress me and who wanted to make me feel shamed about myself, about my existence, about my body, who wanted to force me to wear, you know, this attire, this burqa, niqab and hijab stuff. And on the other hand, I had my mother who wanted to give me a sense of being born a free human being in such gloomy and dark, disappointing environment. Despite of all odds, I would say, she tried her best to give us this sense of freedom. And I think that is the reason that I never left this hope to be free. And this sense of being a free woman remained intact somewhere inside me. Though when I was in Pakistan, I was unable to manifest my opinion and myself in public. However, as I left Pakistan, and I went to Germany. I spent like around a decade in Germany. And I discovered the whole new world. There was freedom, there was equality that I never experienced, you know, in a country where I was born and raised. And there, that sense of freedom that was still there inside me, it came right out. That manifested all my belief, my personality, my opinion on different issues. I used to be skeptical about like maybe religion is not that bad. It's about men. They're trying to oppress women. But later on, this questioning led me to the point where I realized that no, it's not the men. It's the religion. These kind of misogynistic attitudes are emboldened by religious teachings, religious beliefs, traditions, rituals that have been going on, you know, for centuries now. The difference that I discovered between a religiously conservative society, an Islamic society, or the Western, free democratic Western society was that here in the West, people, they have managed to push religion in personal sphere. In countries like France, you have totally a separation between religion and state. But in countries, including UK, I would say that society is largely secular, but there is still not that clear-cut separation between state and religion. Still, the laws are based on secular values. People are treated equally under the law of the land. Minorities, all religious groups, they enjoy freedom to practice their beliefs. And that was striking, of course, for me. I discovered a whole new world. It was surprising, very inspiring, I would say, because the value of having freedom, of having equal rights, I think these are the values that we are born with. And that doesn't matter if we are born in Pakistan or in the UK. These things are like human instincts that we look out for. We want to be free from restrictions. We want to live a life full of dignity, with respect, and we want to work hard and we want to raise a family. These kind of values I did, you know, experience in Pakistan. The opportunity to manifest all those beliefs and values I found in the Western society, I give a huge, huge credit to the Western societies. The fair human dignity has been prioritized over the fragile religious sensibilities.
And now in this column, you said you are worried that secretly Sharia law is creeping into the UK society by allowing this separation of men and women in this charity run. Do you want to give a bit of background to this case?
It's not one event that has brought me to this conclusion. This event was organized by East London Mosque, and this event was labeled as an inclusive event. It was a charity event in a public space, and it's supposed to be a family event. However, they specifically mentioned that the girls above the age of 12 and women, they are not allowed to participate. And I think that was the tipping point to state the obvious. And the obvious was that, yes, there is no Sharia law in policy. However, in practice, we are inclining towards a society that is aligned with certain aspects of Sharia compliance. And in this case, the aspect of Sharia compliance is gender apartheid, misogyny, mistreatment of women. And this has been normalized. And this whole religious modesty stuff or religious freedom to treat women in a less favorable way used to be confined within the four walls of mosque. However, with this incident, we see that those attitudes now are coming out of those premises and becoming a norm in British society. And it is pertinent to mention that this event was not organized very first time. They have been organizing such so-called family-run event for years now, and nobody took an objection to this kind of event and asked a question that, where are your women? Where are your girls? Because this has been normalized. Now we see the prevalence of the hijab culture. Earlier we used to see that only adult women would wear it. Now we see the girls at the age of 4 or 5, babies, are wearing hijab. And girls at the age of 7, 8 onwards are encouraged to wear burqa and niqab in their schools. And it is a common sight in the UK now. This is exactly what happens when religion dictates your morals and your laws. Then this is the outcome we see, the marginalization of women and girls and the child abuse that is done in the name of religion. Because I see it as a child abuse when they make children wear hijab. They rob them of their childhood.
You're saying the political center and the left with the voting system you have in parliament is almost exclusively Labour and will probably consider themselves as the party that has its own history very much tied to feminism. You're saying they have gone silent?
Yes, on the issue of women's rights, women who come from minority background, they are very much silent. And they don't even want to discuss these issues. They are not interested because any effort, any discussion on the issues related to burqa, niqab and hijab, they don't appear to see it as an issue related to women's rights. So I know there has been a history where British people fought against, you know, misogyny, religious misogyny, and they have accomplished equality, not to an idealistic level, yet they have accomplished equality for men and women in their society. However, when it comes to talk about issues which are related to minority women, they don't seem very much interested, especially when it is being discussed in the context of religion, because they see it somehow disturbing this concept of community cohesion. Actually, I've been really proud of this fact that in the West, individuals are not treated as a part of a community. There are individual liberties and freedom, hard-earned freedoms. And they are individual freedoms, not clan freedom or tribe freedom or the rights of a community. It's about a right of one individual. However, in the UK, the prevailing narrative is very much about protecting communities. It's not about protecting minorities within minorities that are suffering in silence. It's about protecting communities. So I think they are betraying their own principle, their own long-standing struggles in terms of women's rights and human rights. And they are caving in to the pressure that is coming from religious fundamentalists, or they are deliberately or unwittingly trying to appease these religious fanatics. And perhaps they think that in doing so, they can keep the situation calm, quote unquote. But in my opinion, the Western civilization and the Western values, they are eating up themselves. There is a decline. The concept of equality for men and women is fading away in the Western society. And particularly, I'm talking about the UK.
What about the Muslim communities themselves? The charity was run by a mosque, which I assume, if they make decisions like that, is ultra-conservative. But I assume there's a large spectrum from entirely secularized Muslims to the very conservative. Is there a debate going on within the Muslim community who should be defining their own rules, whether such a run where women are excluded is something that they see as an appropriate way to present Islam in public?
The thing is, it's a very sad state of affairs. For a long, long time, British politicians, they have not been engaging with the British Muslim communities. They are engaging with the so-called community leaders. These leaders have been given such importance that now they have become the face of the communities. They control the narrative. So there are particular organizations who are conservative in their outlook, or they are conservative or rigid in the assertion of their religious belief. They prefer to engage with them. Recently, an organization, British Muslim organization, Tell Mama, they have been doing incredible work in terms of building bridges between British Muslim community and the mainstream society. And they were also very much vigilant about the problems within certain section of Muslim communities, which are becoming an obstacle in the way of integration and assimilation and engaging with the wider society. So they have been doing incredible work, but for some reason, the Labour government, they decided they don't want to engage with them anymore. So they have chosen another Aziz Foundation, which are very much vocal and assertive in pushing religious orthodoxy in British social and political discourse. They are the ones, if I'm not wrong, who financed to put lights during the whole month of Ramadan, 30 days, they put lights in the streets of London. And they have got the attention of the Labour government. So it's quite telling that they are not interested in moderate voices, in the voices that are working in harmony with the mainstream society. They want to have people who are orthodox religious in their outlook so that they can tell, oh, look, women are wearing niqab and hijab and little girls are covered with abaya and burqa. They are the Muslim, you know, we are engaging with them. But those people who may not wear religion 24/7 on their sleeves, they want to reconcile their faith with British values of tolerance, coexistence, democracy, secularism. They are of no interest to this government. That is the frustration right now, that the face of British Muslim community is very unfavorable. People see this bunch of people on the media talking all the time about Islamophobia, talking all the time about how Muslims are being persecuted. I mean, can you imagine that Muslims are being persecuted in the UK, where they enjoy far more rights they can ever imagine to have in any Muslim-majority country? So, of course, the resentment in the wider society will grow when they will see that society is so orthodox, doesn't want to engage with the mainstream society, doesn't want to celebrate our events we celebrate here in the UK.
In Switzerland, I think there's a similar trend. And one of the reasons why I think the more conservative organisations get more of a voice is that in, say, in Swiss politics, people are used to, you've got the Catholic Church and you've got the Protestant Church. They are all clearly identifiable entities. They have their spokespeople. They're very well-defined hierarchies. So you know if you want to talk to the Catholics or to the Protestants who to address, who will be your recognized partner from within these organizations. And of course, the Muslim community is much more diverse. They come from different countries, have mosques using different languages, the languages of their origins, and that is probably just too confusing. So in Switzerland, they are reverting to umbrella organizations, which might have some liberal communities or mosques included, but the spokespeople always tend to be on the more conservative side. Maybe not as clear Islamist as you've experienced here, but I think the secularized Muslims in Switzerland are also not really being heard because they are not even organized at all. They don't belong to mosques or Muslim community centers or so. Is that maybe something which is also a part of the explanation here, that in politics we were sort of used to religions having a clear structure and always a head that is sort of an official spokesperson for the entire community?
The problem here we have is, as I just explained, that politicians are very much interested in engaging with the most conservative section of British Muslim communities. And then hence the financial aid and the assistance they get from the government, it directly goes to these conservative sections, not to the wider Muslim community. The whole efforts by the authorities, the money, the attention, the time, it's all been invested in one particular section of the community. The thing is, when there is monopoly of radical voices, the normal people who are going about their lives, they don't want to put their lives and their family's life at risk. If I am talking about these issues, then I am always, you know, looking over my shoulder whenever I'm attending an event, whenever I'm talking about these things. On social media, online, the abuse I get is just incredible. You can't just imagine that you are living in a free democratic country where people could be jailed for writing anything on social media. Here, people who are coming from religious background, who think that they are being offended, and it is all justified if they abuse people who supposedly offended them. I mean, that's incredible. For me, it's two-tier society we live in, really, that religious fanatics have been given a green card that you can abuse people online, you can hurl abuse at them when you see them on the roads or in the parks, and you're not going to be in any sort of trouble. So that has emboldened these nefarious elements. And people who are just going about their life, they want to work, they want to raise their kids. They don't want to get into trouble when they are talking about the issues they are facing. They want to have a protective environment where they can feel safe and they can get engaged with the politicians, with the authorities. But they know that they are not the priority of the politicians. And for them, it's like you are speaking at your own risk. If I am talking about this issue, I'm doing it at my own risk. I had a very bad incident at some event, and I wanted to report that event because that was quite threatening. And I literally felt like I could be assaulted. But, you know, I was advised not to do that because the response would be that you need to stop talking about these things and just go about your life. It was like quite a chilling moment for me. But I would say I'm still talking about these issues because that's something that I am emotionally, morally invested. And I really want to see a change coming out of these discussions and debates that I'm holding at the moment with on all levels. Wherever I get the opportunity to talk about these things, I seize that opportunity because I really want people to listen to the argument they never come across on mainstream media or in parliament when they see politicians are talking about it. So for me, it's like there is a lack of interest in the moderate section of the British Muslim community on the part of British politicians and the authorities. And there is discouragement that people don't want to come forward and talk about it. And there is this kind of attitude that people who are more religious, for example, the definition of Islamophobia, why it has been so controversial, why they are unable to convince the whole British society on this one definition. It's because this definition has too little to do with protecting Muslims as people. It's mostly about protecting a particular section of Muslim community, which is very religious in their outlooks. This Muslimness, the concept of Muslimness, It's all about your beard, your clothing, you know, you are identically Muslim. You're wearing hijab. It's not about majority of the British Muslims who don't wear religion 24/7 on their sleeves. So that's been the most important reasons why people have been wary of this definition. And people who are pushing this definition, they have been given the favor.
Can you say in brief how Islamophobia is defined or what this suggestion is that you find
they
problematic?
They are saying that Islamophobia is rooted in racism against Muslims. And then there is a concept of Muslimness that has been attributed to this definition, that the Muslimness needs to be protected. People who are attacked and targeted because of their Muslimness. So I think this needs to be made clear that Muslims are not a race. They come from different backgrounds. They are not a homogenous group. I hate to mention this thing, but their skin color is different. They're coming from different backgrounds, different countries, different culture. You cannot just, you know, lump them all together in one race. And secondly, when they talk about the discrimination and bigotry, if you read this definition in detail, it is considered Islamophobia if you say that Islam was spread by the sword.
Would the same claim about Christianity be?
No, of course not. I mean, that's the thing, that we wouldn't even dream of giving this sort of privilege to Christianity and not say that Christianity never did anything bad, you know, in the past. And there is no punishment, there is no problem. Nobody's going to come at us and tell us that you have disrupt public order or you are committing a crime or blasphemy. However, Islam is treated differently. The same justice that the grooming gang members who are predominantly Pakistani Muslims, bringing attention to this fact is also Islamophobia. Talking about certain stereotypes related to Muslims, that extremist and Islamist and terrorist can be Muslim, it is also Islamophobia. It means actually that you cannot discuss anything which is associated with and related to Islam. It's not about Muslims. Because when we talk about terrorism, we tend to discuss Islam at length. We don't discuss Muslims as people that, oh, all Muslims are terrorists. We say there is a problem with the ideology and there are certain vulnerable people who are being brainwashed with this vile ideology. We need to talk about it. So they want to ring fence Islam, and they have made quite a list of excuses why they want to do it. But it's heartening to see that there is a pushback, that people are not letting, Labour would do it. Labour would endorse this definition. You know, they are unable to do it because there's been a pushback. There are certain organizations, UK humanist organizations, secular society, there's Free Speech Union. They are forming a resistance, and generally people are having this conversation and they don't want to see this definition being codified into law or whatever. They don't want to actually codify this definition into law. They just want to make a definition.
Which would be what, binding for courts then?
Exactly. Or, that would be added in the consideration wherever there would be such incident related to the definition, whatever is mentioned in the definition. So it is a facade when they say that, oh, it would not be a legal binding. It would be. And then they compare it with anti-Semitism. We know that anti-Semitism is about protecting people. It's not about protecting Judaism as a faith. People can criticize Judaism. People can criticize what is written in the religious scripture, religious tradition. The misogyny that is there. I know there are Jewish people here in the UK. They talk about it and they overtly criticize their religion for having these kind of misogynistic bits. No organized religion can claim that they are the most feminist religion, and that applies to Islam as well. But they try to make it all about, oh, if you can have anti-Semitism, why not Islamophobia? Clear differences. That is about people, anti-Semitism definition, and the definition of Islamophobia is about religion, about protecting religion, religious belief, and religious orthodoxies, and religious misogyny.
You mentioned Humanist UK and the National Secular Society, two organizations that grew from criticizing primarily Christianity, of course. That's their historical background. But of course, they do see themselves as advocates for the non-religious population, and both stand for a separation of church and state. So how much do they support your work?
I have not been engaged with them like on personal level. However, I know that they are very much involved in criticism of all religion, including Islam, and they talk about ex-Muslims, they talk about women's rights in Islam, in within certain section of Muslim communities. So I find similarities in our principle, in our views and opinions when it comes to, you know, religious orthodoxy. So I'm very much a fan of these two societies. They are working on incredible issues here, which are important for any free democratic society. And they are voice of reason, because you know that there are still Orthodox Christian people, Orthodox Jewish people, Orthodox Hindu people, Orthodox Muslims. They would all prefer to have a religious society where you can have blasphemy laws, where their feelings are not being heard and all that. And they are doing God's work, actually. I know that it's a bit strange to say, but actually the importance of their work is phenomenal. And I really appreciate that we have these kind of societies in Britain who are pushing back these kind of narratives, and they are trying to bring attention to those issues. For example, the issue of ex-Muslim. People here in the UK, they don't even recognize that ex-Muslim is a community, though we are not a community. Again, we are individuals. We have different values, different principles, and different reasons why we are ex-Muslims. But still, the thing that brings us together is the criticism of religion and religious orthodoxy. And we don't want it to be dominant in our political and social discourse. That is one thing that we work on in togetherness, I would say. And I think these two societies, they have been working hard to bring attention to the plight of the ex-Muslims in Britain, because they are telling the people here that these people, they are denouncing their religion at the expense of their lives, actually. They cannot denounce Islam in public. They cannot criticize the religion they were born into. And they have been disregarded. They have been discredited for the work they do in order to bring attention to the Islamism, political Islam. The discussion I have had with ex-Muslims here in Britain, or all over, I would say, in Europe, I think ordinary people, they are still far behind in those conversations, because they don't see the threat Islamic orthodoxies pose to the Western values. But they are the people who are doing it at the expense of their lives. And they are doing what the ordinary people, they cannot even realize right now, that there is a danger. You know, they see the danger whenever there is an act of terrorism. They don't see a danger when a mosque is discriminating against women in public space. For them, it's like, oh, it's okay. What's the big deal? I mean, this is their religion, you know, this is their culture. But they don't know that these kind of attitudes, they're going to catch up with this sooner or later. As I say, the threats of religious misogyny and religious orthodoxy, it reaches far beyond your imagination, and it can affect all sections of the society. You cannot say that it's their culture. You know, the heat of anything that is going on in one particular section of the society, it's going to reach you one way or another. So people can see us for the work we are doing, but UK Humanist and National Secular Society, they have been highlighting the work ex-Muslims do here in the UK, and they have been supporting people. I've not been personally engaged with any of these societies, but I look forward to working with them if any opportunity arises in the future. And I really appreciate the work they do.
Shall we end with a positive note? There was a recent court case, an appeal. A Turkish atheist had burned the Quran in front of the Turkish embassy in London, and he was convicted. It was seen as an act of hatred. And for him, it was, even though probably most of us would use a different form of criticism rather than burning a book, but he saw it clearly as a criticism of the close ties between the Turkish government and Islamism. His appeal was supported, so you are still allowed to take a rather radical form to criticize, in this case, Islam, or criticize religion, or criticize the ties between religion and governments. This was 17 years after Britain had removed its blasphemy law. So some things still seem to be holding up. Do you want to comment on this case? Because I think for ex-Muslims, this was a case that had been closely followed and seen as important.
I would love to end our conversation on a positive note. However, I mean, that's the reality. We are talking about ground realities, and they are grim at the moment. You just mentioned about a very important case, Hamid Koskun. He is a Turkish man, and he protested outside the Turkish consulate by burning a copy of Quran. And he wanted to protest against the Islamization of his country. And he said bad things about Islam. He said bad things about Islamic extremism. And there was a man who felt offended and who attacked him with a knife. And it was quite brutal attack. He got injured. And instantly, Hamid Koskun was arrested for burning the copy of Quran. And he was charged with disrespecting or attacking the institution of Islam, which was clearly a blasphemous charge. And this is blasphemy against a religious institution. And that is not something new. There were several instances when people were charged with blasphemy and against the institution of religion. So they did bring the same thing in this case. However, there was a backlash because since there is no blasphemy laws here at the moment, so then they did all that mental gymnastic, make it all about public order or how he made other people uncomfortable, including the man who attacked him with a knife. He actually hurt his feelings, so he ought to be held accountable for that. And he was convicted, sadly. And it was a sad, sad moment in the British history, recent history, I would say. And that will stay there forever because this incident of convicting a man protesting against Islam has set a dangerous precedent in this country. Unwittingly, unknowingly, or deliberately, I am not sure. The credence has been given to the belief of those extremists who want to act in a moment of rage against those people whom they find as blasphemers. So this dangerous precedent has been set with this one conviction. I know that this,
even though the case has been overturned.
Yes, yes, even though because the case was appealed, it was supported by National Secular Society and Free Speech Union, the case has been overturned. However, the damage, as I said, has been done because this has made people believe that we are not, after all, very wrong when we are acting in a violent or aggressive way because we are the victim. Because the person who attacked Hamid Koskun has been made a victim. It was not Hamid who was a victim. It was that man because his feelings were hurt. Therefore, the message that has been conveyed through this whole case is dangerous, and it has attracted lots of attention from the extremist section of British Muslim community because they must have felt we were right after all. So it's our right to defend our religious belief, our religious scripture, our prophet's honor by acting aggressively. This whole situation is so grim, really. It's really hard for me to say that things might take a turn to a positive direction. But of course, I'm not a pessimist. I still hope that we will continue at least to strive to bring forth a change in the thinking of people by having these kind of discussion and debates. And we need support from the politicians. We need support from influential people in this society. And I hope they realize it before it is too late. If they can realize there is this threat that comes from Islam, I'm not saying from Muslims. Muslims are so diverse and they don't go by the book, by every word of Quran or every single Islamic teaching. They are living their lives. So the threat that comes from the conservative and radical section of the British community, I hope that these people, they can just foresee it and they can act in accordance and then they can support those people who are literally putting their lives, their time, their energies at risk just to bring their attention to what has gone wrong in the society.
Which is one reason why you need to stay active, I guess. And I'm very, very thankful for you and all the others we both know and many yeah. more I'm probably not even aware of are doing the same type of work. Be thankful for your activism and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you over and over again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Angus.